Hey, everybody, this is Kevin Kautzman with the podcast Get This. It's the show about things people love, coming to you from the Corona Bunker here in upstate Manhattan on Tuesday, March 17th, in the foul year of our Lord 2020. And again, every day that passes, that becomes more clear. One of the very worst years ever. I'm joined by not one, not two, but three of my very favorite people in the world. I have my fiance, Sabra Corcoran, here. Hey, Sabra.
Hello.
Hello, Sabra.
And just to be clear, Sabra and I are quarantined together, and we're joined remotely by the one and only
Jose Ignacio Gomez. Should I speak closer to the microphone?
You're fine. And second time guest on the show, Michael Backinson. You're an actor.
Correct.
Yeah.
That is correct.
So what do you want to talk about today?
So, you know, 2020 was starting out pretty great. To be honest, I was having an awesome 2020 until this whole thing arrived. I know we're doing a clean show here, so we'll keep it clean. I started out the year unexpectedly getting a job offer to participate in the pre-Broadway tryout of the stage adaptation of The King's Speech, which was written by David Seidler originally in 1980, before film came out, like 30 years before the film came out. So he brought it back to the stage. It was done in London a few years ago, and they're trying to bring it to Broadway here in New York. Again, it got a little bit derailed with the coronavirus. So anyway, I thought that was something cool to talk about, just because it was a big passion project of mine for the first couple months of the year.
Right. So let me get the facts straight. So the first was the book, then the movie, and then the play. And
now
the play.
No, first, David, I'll just do a little backstory on David Seidler.
Right.
He wrote for film and television, but he was born in England shortly before World War II broke out. So he survived the Blitz. His family's home was actually hit by a bomb. And he moved into the country, and then they decided to move to America. So he moved to America as a young child, and the trauma of that experience gave him a stutter.
Oh, wow. Right.
That was something that he spent, I think it wasn't until he was in his teens that he kind of was able to get control of that. And a hero of his had been King George of England, who was the king during World War II. And because it was brought to his attention, and his parents kept saying, this guy had a stutter and he overcame it. So he was just fascinated by what that story was. So many years later, as an adult, when he was done with television writing, or not done with it, but looking to follow kind of a passion project, he started to write this play, which became The King's Speech. He wrote to I think his manager or the production company required him to get permission from the Queen Mum, who is featured in it. She's the wife of King George and was still alive at the time. And she said, great idea, but that was the worst time of my life, and I don't want this portrayed while I'm still alive. So he was like, okay, she's 80 years old. We'll put it up maybe in 5 or 6 years.
Oh, geez.
she lived to be 103. So he blew the dust off of his manuscript in 2003 and tried to get it produced as a play, adapted into a film. No one would give him the time of day. They're like, who wants to watch a film about a king that stutters?
Did they do it in that accent, that exact accent?
They did. That was my Harvey Weinstein accent.
Oh, jeez. Yeah, right. Right. Whatever happened to old Harvey?
I don't know where that came from. But okay.
You think you're having a bad year?
Yeah. That guy.
Yeah.
But I actually used to work for
23 years. Same time, right? 23 years.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. For the King's Speech.
Interesting.
For the
weird kismet.
Let's play that number.
You were saying, Michael?
So I actually, when I was a reader for Miramax, the script came to my desk. Unsolicited, he didn't have he wrote it on spec, and eventually somebody took a chance on it. Tom Hooper directed the film, and went on to win all these Academy Awards.
Awesome movie, yeah.
Yeah, but it was like 30 years in the making.
Insane.
What an amazing story! That's really inspiring.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. So, and it's interesting. It appeals to a lot, you know, yes, it's a king that stutters, but it's the demographics that it appeals to is pretty widespread. It's sort of, you know, anyone who's faced challenges in their life.
Right. You can be what the Lord of the Realm during a very trying time and also have what amounts to a disability. And
yeah,
the contrast there is quite profound and lovely.
Yeah.
Yeah. I recall liking the film. Yeah. I thought it was a fine film.
Yeah, it's also kind of, you know, a buddy picture. It's about a unique friendship between people of very different backgrounds. The speech specialist that I played in the play and Jeffrey Rush played in the movie is this kind of, you know, lower middle class guy from Western Australia, which couldn't have been more remote in the 19-teens and 20s when he moved to England, who just through his sheer talent and kind of determination ended up being this expert that allowed the king to overcome his stutter.
Yeah, that's quite a story. That's really about two people overcoming something.
Mm-hmm.
Mm. Yeah, lovely. And so you were cast in this play down in D.C.?
Correct. Well, I was cast here. It was supposed to be part of this larger tour. I wasn't sure if I could make all the dates. I was offered the D.C. portion of the out-of-town tryouts. And as it happens, everything else got canceled so far.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But yeah, we rehearsed it in New York. It had been done in Chicago with some different actors. Some of the actors were the same. The two lead actors were recast, as was one of the lead actresses. So I came into it in New York and then took it down to D.C. to the National Theater, which is this huge, ancient Broadway roadhouse down there, like 1,700 seats, built in 1835.
How many, and you were playing in front of how many people?
1,700.
Wow. What was that like?
Yeah. It was fantastic. I mean, it was, it was wild. It was, you know, you'd have some nights, you know, a packed house, standing ovations, but it was, you know, the stage lights on, you can't see anything. You just kind of hear this roar coming at you.
And
you look
lights.
up, and it's like, I don't know, looking at the top of a tall building is where the audience goes up to.
Is there an intermission in that show?
Yeah. Yeah. It's a pretty tight show. I think it's like an hour, first act, 45 minutes, second act.
Kevin's all about the intermission.
I love a good intermission. I know. I'm trying to understand the structure of the show.
All right.
Hey, I'm a playwright. This stuff matters.
I know. I actually did see the King's Speech. I really enjoyed it. And then I think there's this particular scene in the movie where he's trying to help him learn how to speak, but he understands, like, if he blocks out the sound of hearing himself, then he can speak properly. And then I'm always kind of in a YouTube hole, and I came across these documentaries in the UK, and they did like educating these specific regions of the UK. Mm-hmm. And this one kid had this really bad stutter in Yorkshire, and the teacher tried this because he had to, like, you know, I think he had to do some sort of speech for his college entrance. And they actually used this tactic on him, and he was actually able to get through the whole speech. So it was really, I think that was like the most inspiring part of it.
Yeah, I got another story. It's like there's this famous Venezuelan songwriter from the 80s called Giordano Di Marzio. Mm-hmm. He's a Italian background, I guess, but Venezuelan. But he studied in my high school, you know, when I was a kid, and they used to call him Machine Gun because he was stuttering. That was a bully. But, you know, Venezuela is very, very normal to bully everybody. Anyway, it's like, so he had this problem. He was stuttering all the time when he was speaking at that, like, you know, it was crazy. But when he sing, like, it was completely going away. And he is like one of the best songwriters from Venezuela, poets, like, beautiful. His lyrics are beautiful, beautiful, beautiful.
Yeah. I mean, that's really common, and that's addressed in the film and the theater show. Is that one of the techniques he uses is to get him to sing through things that he's stammering over. So I say, like, try Swanee River. I was trying.
That's funny.
And how did you work on your accent for the show? Did you try one on?
Yeah, that was actually a real challenge. It was interesting. There was a wonderful speech dialect coach that we worked with from Chicago. And we just made some sort of basic decisions. One was that because it's referenced in the text and it's also referenced in the historical record, that Lionel Logue could not, even though he was a speech specialist, he had trouble fully shedding his Australian accent. Mm-hmm. But he was doing his darndest to do royal pronunciation, RP. Sure. So we kind of had to go from a perspective of doing the royal, the RP, but blending in occasionally certain vowels that had the Australian color to them.
Why anyone would want to be rid of the mellifluous, the famously beautiful Australian accent is beyond me. I love an Aussie accent. I think Aussies are great.
Did you just record that and just show it to Monica? I'm going to record that.
Make an ISO of that and see, you know, Monica will be knocking at the door.
I love that you're wearing Monica's like sunglasses right now as well.
This is Mon sunglasses, and this is what she used when she used her dryer. Whenever she got her hair wet.
Monica is very famously Jose's significant other. I've taken some screenshots so you can see what Jose looks right now, because this is an audio podcast. It'll be on the show notes at getthispodcast.com. And you look like a professional wrestler.
It's just an apocalyptic.
Right, you do. You look like an extra from Mad Max, speaking of Australia.
Yeah, mm-hmm. In the last sip of the gasoline right here. Oh,
there you go.
Right.
By the way, happy St. Patrick's Day, everybody.
Happy St. Patrick's Day, everybody.
St. Patrick's Day, yeah.
Wow.
None of us are wearing green, I noticed.
Oh,
I am.
Corporate is. Okay. You have to be.
Yeah. But you going back to Michael, like, Michael is one of those people that just show up in your life. And they're like, oh my God, this guy's so interesting. Like, he's been an actor all of his life. Mm-hmm. He knows a lot about Shakespeare and he's read a lot. And he's really a theater actor. Like, he's like, he was born into this. Like, it's amazing. And he's also a super cool guy. So,
Yeah, really. Yeah.
Anything you want to, I don't know, how do you feel like the young Michael, you know, starting to be an actor and this, and then, wow, I'm doing King's Speech in Washington. I know you have done many other stuff, but.
Well, it was, that's why 2020 felt so amazing, because it was such kismet with this particular role. Playing Lionel Logue, he kind of founded the speech and voice movement that my wife and I met in graduate school. She ended up getting certified in it later. I teach voiceover as a professor. I use it with my classes. I use it the warm-ups all the time. And they descended from this guy that I got to portray.
Wow, so that's cool.
An incredible feeling to be playing a real, you know, a real historical figure that I had in some ways already had connections to. But this, you know, interestingly enough, having done theater since I was, I don't know, 10 or 11 years old, I had done it every single year until my daughter was born. And then I did some workshops of things. Wow. I did some readings of stuff, including Kevin's great play, Moderation. But this was my first full production since my daughter was born. So it was a return to the theater for me, which was really gratifying.
And that's not a mild return either. That's pretty significant to go into a venue.
It was
like
wild.
That. Yeah.
I was kind of like keeping the panic attack at bay when we were sitting down, because it was a very truncated rehearsal process. They already had it blocked, which is where you have, you know, where the patterns on stage, where you have entrances and exits. We only had a couple of weeks to kind of get up to speed. We're into tech, and our first run through was in front of 1,500 people.
Wow.
We had never done the play start to finish with tech until the first paying audience.
Gracious.
Wow.
That's nerve-wracking. Yeah.
It really was.
Yeah.
How'd everybody do? How'd you hold up?
I mean, it was great. It was electric. It was exciting. Mm. Me and the other lead who's playing the king, we would meet every single show about 45 minutes before to run our scenes as fast as possible. Because
bam, 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 bam.
We had not had the rehearsal time to really get solid on stuff. So we were right up through the closing of the show, we were meeting to run lines.
I'm losing my breath thinking about that right now. Go on, Jose.
Yeah. No, it's beautiful. Yeah, no, I'm with the image of the whole situation. Did you, when did you start feeling confident? Or Because I know there's always that little nerve when you go to the first time on stage, and then you're just like, and then everything is like, okay, I can do this.
Yeah. You know, it really felt like, who's that guy that walked between the World Trade Center towers?
Yeah, the yes. Philippe, train?
The Frenchman.
I think it's Philippe. Is that his name?
Something like that.
Remember the documentary.
Yeah, it was kind of like that. Like, you know, that you've got the... You know, you've got the experience. You've done it.
Yeah.
You've done it in your retreat in Colorado, 8 feet above the ground. But until you actually get on between the World Trade Center,
that's
several thousand feet up, you're kind of bouncing around a little bit. It's windy.
Yeah, but that's an idea. That's an extreme situation, because I actually compare being in the moment. We actors say that a lot. Being in the moment for me is like, I compare it like with surfing. I'm not a surfer. Yeah. But I don't know why I like the idea of being on a wave. And once you get in, it's something that you just got to go with it until it's done.
Yeah. I mean, luckily we didn't have the luxury of feeling like anything had become rote. You were really discovering something completely new every time you did it. And it got faster, louder, funnier, whatnot, as the show went on.
How many characters are in this?
Well, it was a big cast, actually. I think there were about 15 or 17 actors in the cast. People moving the sets on and off, and then a few supporting roles. So it was, you know, kind of a chorus of people, as well as King George the VI's father, his wife, my wife, his brother who abdicated the throne, his mistress, Wallace Stimson. So it sort of covered, as well as Winston Churchill, and several other political figures of the time, including the Archbishop of Canterbury.
Mm-hmm. Big play.
Cosmo Lang.
Big play.
Big play.
Beautiful. Mm-hmm. It's a beautiful story. Definitely.
Right. So he writes it as a play. It ends up in the drawer because of the Queen Mom, who lives to be 103 because good genes and presumably great medical care. Clean living. And
a couple of glasses of gin every day.
Right. Yeah. Just
that's
gin.
How they stay alive.
Hey, a little bit of gin. It never hurt anybody. And then he brings it out, adapts it into a film, and it gets made into a film. And now finally it's come back to the stage. And did they do this in the UK?
They did. They did it on London. It did quite well there. And they're trying to, you know, they're trying to make this happen right now. Of course, Broadway completely shut down. But we had the Schuberts come down and see it. Catherine Schreiber, who's this incredible, she won like producer of the year a couple years ago. She was down there, a big booster for it. And a guy named Michael Alton. Has been shepherding it ever since London, sort of his pet project. And I was concerned, like, you know, I know they're going to try to get some big famous star for this at some point. But I met him at the bar after one of the previews, and we talked for, I want to say, an hour and a half. And he said, you know, why do I have to create, why do I have to create some musical based on something else? You know, I forget what example he used, like Happy Days the musical or something. You know, why do I have to create this stunt? Why do I have to have celebrity casting? Why can't I just do a good show, tell an amazing story? And it was, you know, who knows if he's going to be able to get the financing to do it with somebody like, you know, little old me. But to hear it from the person who's created this current production was really gratifying.
Well, after you have the Get This bump, anything's possible.
Exactly.
No. And then I think that's the beauty of the story. It's a guy, you know, like you say, a lower class guy that, you know, make it to be best friend of the king. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of part of like, you are that person, you know, already. Yeah. You know? Not like you're poor. I mean, I think you're doing pretty well, you know, based on, you know, the average.
Yeah, but that, a lot of that was what he was working with. Definitely. He wanted him to sing stuff. He wanted to swear stuff, and he wanted to get him off of his pedestal and recognize that this throne is nothing but a stage prop. This crown is nothing but a costume piece. And you got to talk through that mic to your audience as if you're talking to a friend. So you need to know what it's like to be a friend. Yeah. You need to be able to, you know, adjust your status accordingly.
Yeah, and that's what actors actually. Well, that's my main goal as an actor or as a human being, all the time. Just find my own voice.
Yes.
Find my voice. And then you as an actor know this. And in spite of the play, it's like you have a voice. That's the main message of the whole play. You got a voice.
I found my voice when I was 14, so ha.
I definitely know that. Sabra. They say Sabra in Spanish is Sabra.
Yeah.
So how many performances did you get to do, Michael?
Oh, my gosh. It was, you know, all told, it was, a run-through and eight performances.
And I bet that last one, it must have been bittersweet because you're just getting into it, right? You feel like you could do it for 3 more months.
Absolutely. Yeah. Although, in some ways, it was a tremendous gift because sometimes shows drag on. You end up losing the passion or people, kind of falls apart for one reason or another. And to have it kind of just be this sweet, perfectly wrapped little project. Yeah. And not little, but to have it be a short time was kind of gratifying in its own way.
Yes.
Mm. Fascinating. Yeah. Right. And where did
I had to get back. My wife was, we're co-directing a show that she completely was taking over for the first 2 weeks of it because I was out of town.
And presumably that's canceled now as well.
Yes, that was canceled 4 days before opening.
Wow.
Four days.
Right. Yeah. Right. Crazy. And Michael, you went to grad school in San Diego, correct?
Yeah. UC San Diego.
And where are you from originally? Yeah.
I'm originally from Portland, Oregon.
Long way from home.
Yeah.
We're all in the same neighborhood here in Manhattan, by the way. Everybody's up in Washington Heights, but we're in three different apartments right now because of
coronavirus. We're probably a thousand feet away or something like that from each other.
When we hear the emergency vehicles coming by, it's like it's probably Jose first, then me, then you.
Has anyone else found it feels a little eerie lately, especially in the mornings? The sound is just not quite as intense as it typically is. Have you noticed that?
I'm enjoying it, though.
You mean the sound of the city? Yeah, I was just talking about that with Monica in the morning. But I think it's a silence in the world. You know, like a different. You know, it's like everybody just be quiet for one day, a couple of days. It's gonna be fine. You know, and I think it's beautiful. I mean, I really feel bad about all the people that is, you know, being sick and is dying. There's a lot of people dying. I'm really sad about that. But oh my God, I don't know. I feel like
they're suggesting that they're supporting the people who are sick are like, yeah, stay apart from each other. Like, this is gonna help. So they can agree that, and I think everybody needs a few days off. Everybody needs their days of Netflix and chill.
Well, what's happening? A lot of Netflix and chill going on. Well, they're going to be the corona babies in 9 months.
Quarantine.
Oh, my gosh.
Right. Think about that. And then in 13 years, they're going to be the quarantines.
Right.
That
should be the new excuse for, you know, not going to show up for work in the future. It's like Netflix and chilling.
Netflix and chilling.
I can't go to work.
See how long that lasts. Michael, presumably you know a lot of actors in town here. Of course, we all kind of do, but you're really keyed into this. What's the community saying about this situation with Broadway shutting down? A lot of people are out of work. People tend to live check to check, or if not quite that, not everybody has a really robust savings account. And we're talking about artists here. So what's the word on the street?
I mean, it's kind of frightening, you know? I mean, I was putting myself on tape for a pilot last week, and it got canceled, and I have a friend who's shooting this big series for Netflix. It's done now for a while. They have the first season in the can, and they were 4 days away from having the second season in the can. But you know, who knows? Who knows when stuff will resume? I mean, if you can't have more than 10 people meeting together, how are you going to put on, a play? A TV show, much less a play. So I don't know how people are reacting. I don't follow that many people on social media. Nick Westrate, that I was doing the show with, posted something about some production companies are still paying their actors.
Well, that's cool.
I didn't DM him to see if he was getting paid still from the King's Speech because he was going to continue on to Hartford and Toronto, which both got canceled. So I don't know if they were going to pay him for a few weeks of that or something, but I know some people are getting paid still, but at a certain point that's going to dry up and who knows what's going to happen.
Yeah. Who knows? But by the way, I just got some kind of tips for the crisis. Like SAG-AFTRA is giving away funds from the SAG-AFTRA Foundation. So for SAG-AFTRA members, I think we are on pause. There's like a family thing going on in Michael House.
Yeah, no, that's all right. You know, if this thing goes on for more than 4 weeks, it starts to get pretty real. I think 2 to 4 weeks, we can kind of weather it. Obviously, people are going to be hurting. Yeah. Nobody's loving this. If it starts to go on much further than that, it starts to get very weird.
Sure.
Yeah.
And I'm sure, Jose, I mean, you live on tips.
Yeah, I mean, yeah.
That's on tips. Gone.
On tips. No, on tips. Okay.
Yeah.
Sorry, I shouldn't say any.
Yeah. Yeah, but I mean, propinas.
Yeah, yeah, no, definitely. Yeah, no, I know. I mean, it's so weird. I know. I think I should be scared. I've been in worse situations before, you know, in my economics, with my money. But I don't know. I think I'm relaxed right now because I feel that the atmospheres in the world has switched for a moment. With all these noises in the news and the same noises that has gone forever and ever, it's good to have this silence and this reflection moment and feel like we're all together one time and connected to the internet and talking to each other and in the same situation, seeing how fragile we are and mm-hmm. how much we really need each other. So, you know, we need to really get into that, man.
And we also need to not read the news every 5 minutes like I have. It's really kind of daunting. Yeah. It's not good mentally. So I think we're going to start practicing, like, turning off our phones at night. Just being like,
And it's definitely not easy. It's definitely not easy, and it's definitely scary times. But at the same time, it's, you know, okay, what do we do?
Yeah.
I'm kind of wondering if it's going to come back with a whimper or a bang, right? Is there going to be a day where they just go, okay, we're done, or are they going to roll things back slowly? Because it kind of rolled out a little slowly. It was first this is travel, you know, this travel ban, then this travel ban, then, okay, now we're going to shut the schools down, and now we're going to do this, you know? I kind of wonder if there's any more surprises coming. Are we going to see bridges? I don't think so. I certainly hope not.
No, because people need to eat.
So yeah, the next 2 weeks are going to be very telling. Michael, getting back to the mm-hmm. show.
Yeah.
How did you prepare for something like that so quickly? Did you pick up some books and just start reading? What was the story there?
Yeah, I did. There was something written by Lionel Logue's grandson named Mark Logue. With somebody, I believe it was from The Guardian, or let me see where it was from. It's from the Sunday Times, a journalist named Peter Conradi. Just a great history of the era, the lead up to it. And there are a lot of differences between the actual story and the theater show, because David dramatized it. So he compressed the action. He put a lot of the work that they had done together maybe 10 years before World War II and mm-hmm. put it right on the eve of World War II so that that was a lot more dramatic.
Yeah, there's a shorter clock.
So I kind of plunged into that, but really, you know, most of the work comes in the rehearsal room and just taking the leap, learning the lines, playing with your scene partner, and then having the feedback from the director. So we got proficient with things. We got the heart, the emotional part of it. But then the director who I've worked with before is wonderful. His name is Michael Wilson. He will often, right at the last minute, give these kind of big picture notes and really heartfelt notes right at the end. Like you're in tech and it's like that last missing piece. For instance, just the relationship with my wife, the fact that the stakes of things, she's, you know, that we're in a marriage that's on the verge of failure. So maybe at the beginning of rehearsal, I didn't really grasp the stakes of that within the relationship. But that adding that layer in made the whole performance make more sense. The stakes of why I need to work with this king and succeed has to do with my own marriage and whether or not it's going to survive. So that was it. You know, you're just memorizing lines from the moment you wake up to the moment you go to bed, and then you dream about the play.
Right.
Beautiful.
Yeah. Fun. Well, so if this year had not been interrupted by Corona, what were the next three? What was the show you were working on?
So, and it's a wonderful play. It's called Polaroid Stories. It's by a playwright named Naomi Azuka. She was commissioned by the Playwright Center in Minneapolis.
Yep.
In the mid-90s, she proposed this thing of interviewing homeless teens there, and she combined it with Greek myths, specifically from the Metamorphoses. Ovid's The Metamorphosis. So it's this wonderful combination of like real interviews that have been kind of twisted and bent and recreated as Ovid's Metamorphosis. And my wife had wonderful ideas for it about it's kind of almost like everybody's trapped in Hades. So the set was like this triangular thing that the people were trapped on. And the students were, I mean, in wonderful shape. We did a full run through on the set, no lights, no costumes, no anything, but we got that in. And I just got it on my iPhone. So I've got these huge five gigabyte, act one, 6 gigabytes for act two. Going to edit it together and distribute it to them. So we've got that. We've got a live record of it.
Where was that? Right.
This is at Lehman College, where we're both professors, adjunct professors there.
And where is Lehman College?
So for people that know the Bronx, let's say if you take the one train up to about 231st Street, get off there, you walk up a hill. It's about a 15 to 20 minute walk from the one train, or you can take the BD to Grand Concourse. The six goes up there. There's a big reservoir up there, these kind of old apartment buildings. And then the campus itself, I believe it used to be, I'm going to get in trouble here. I think it used to be the campus for Hunter College before it moved to Manhattan. So it has this beautiful kind of Gothic revival, that kind of thing in the 20s and 30s, like Yale has, like these old stone buildings, and then kind of newer 60s era buildings. And it's got a pretty great music and arts auditorium, and then a theater center that has a studio theater and a much larger theater.
Great. Hey, if you want to send some stills of the what you had there from the stage, send those.
That'd be cool. To see that's a nice idea.
Throw them in the show notes.
Get
this podcast.com. Go on, Jose.
Sorry. How about the rest of the cast? And on the play, like any actors, with a big trajectory or anything that you want to share about that?
In The King's Speech?
Uh-huh, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know how famous it would be outside of theater circles, but Nick Westrate, who was in it, I had seen on Broadway in Casa Valentina, and he did a show about Hamlet with, I'm going to space on her name now, anyway, Nick is a Broadway performer. He was on Turn, that show about the spies during the Revolutionary War. He was a series regular there for a couple of years. And then the other people were Maggie Lacey, who's a great, again, Broadway actress. Elizabeth Lado was a Chicago actress. And a guy named John Judd, a great Chicago actor. So they had this sort of like a great core group of Chicago actors, and then brought in the three of us from New York.
How was the feeling between the cast, between you guys? You get along together very well immediately?
Yeah, we really bonded. And I really liked Nick. He's a very talented, very funny, very smart guy. And I think we both knew that we were going to have to sink or swim together. And so we just really supported each other and were positive and developed a friendship over the course of it. It was pretty great. And the Chicago company was terrific too. They came in and they were so supportive. They only had like a couple of days to re-rehearse the thing before they went into tech, because it was just the kind of the four core members of the company that were there for the first couple of weeks. So those Chicago guys were really supportive, and it was a good company.
Good.
How long were you in DC?
Just about 2 weeks.
Wow, that's a whirlwind, man.
And it was crazy.
Yeah.
And I was told a week before I went into rehearsal, they're like, what do you think about this? I'd auditioned for it in December. So, it was out of my mind.
Here we go.
I remember you telling me, I'm doing The King's Speech. And I thought it was like, I'm just going to go to DC, rehearse, all of that. And then no, we are already doing the rehearsals here in New York. And in 1 week, we got to be there. I was like, what? Yeah. Are you going to do this? actors, we're crazy.
Yeah, and I didn't realize that you adjunct. So you adjunct voice? Is that what you do? You teach?
Yeah, I do voice, and I've taught acting there as well. But I don't teach – what I teach is voiceover. That was something that I got into for a while doing audiobooks. So the head of the program met me. My wife was already there teaching voice, Tamala Backinson. And he said, well, we need a voiceover teacher. It meets like once a week. It's like a 3-hour course. Do you think you could do that? So I'm actually podcasting is one of the units that I teach in the class.
Hey,
Maybe I could have you come in and lecture.
Sure. Yeah. No, I love that. I don't know. Right. You just bring me in by Skype.
So Kevin is a natural. Kevin is a natural. The first time I was in a podcast with him, I think I wasn't part of it. I was just listening. But then Kevin is always talk to you with his. He have a baritone voice, but then he get into the microphone. He's like, "Yeah, Kevin Kutzman."
All right,
that's
okay.
Actually what my parents said. They're like, "He's got a great voice."
Thank you. That's nice. Right. Yeah. Yeah. No, that's fun. That's cool that you do that. And she teaches voice there too.
She teaches voice and acting as well. Yeah. So, we have this connection there. It's somebody that years ago, actually, a woman that attended our wedding and. I went to school with him and he was my best man at our wedding. She's been teaching there as a professor of theater history for, I want to say 10 or 12 years. Wow. And so she reached out to us a couple years ago, offered Tamala a job. She started working there and then I started working there and, you know, we were all set to direct this thing there together.
Do you think you'll pick it up? You must.
I think so. I think it's going to happen. It's going to be tough, but actually immediately before doing this, I was on a conference video with the whole theater department. And there was a guy that was, he's the last man on campus. So Chris was videoing from backstage where he had been working all day, putting all the safety railings on our set because he didn't want to leave a set that was like this dangerous set.
Sure. Yeah.
So he was, you know, screwing every last nail or every last screw and putting up the railings and making sure that it was safe and ready to go because nothing is going to happen there until, you know, the ban is lifted. And then presumably we'll hopefully reconvene the cast, rehearse a little bit, go into tech and put it up ASAP. But of course, nobody knows where that is.
If you get to know this, how much money was involved in this production? Any idea about that?
The King's Speech.
King's Speech?
Yeah, the King's Speech.
Oh, I mean, millions.
Really? Wow.
Yeah. Pretty serious.
Crazy. Yeah.
But these producers, they've got money and they know what they're in for. when they get involved in a play, it's like opening a restaurant. You know what the percentages are. You can't make a living, but you can make a killing.
Yeah.
Well, it's a straight play too. What a thing to mount. You know, you have the movie behind it. It's historical, big cast, nice story, great story. So
the vibe from the people who were on the board of directors at the National Theater in DC, it was extremely positive because they're used to bringing in basically Broadway shows on tour or Broadway musicals that are trying to go to New York. And this was like one of the first straight plays that they'd had in years and years. And they loved it. You know, they were so excited to have something that's just a straight drama and not a flashy musical.
Musicals can be exhausting. Mm-hmm. I love musicals, but they can be exhausting. There is something to be said about a straight play.
I could live in a musical. I don't know what you all are talking about. Yeah. Don't ask me to sing, though. That would be a terrible idea.
Don't sing on this podcast. No. I forbid it.
Or ever.
John Judd, who was in the play, he was playing the elder king. He was just a terrific actor and really one of these older veterans of the theater with interesting stories. But he said about musicals, he said, "I don't know, man. I can't do it. It embarrasses me. I see people, they're in a scene and then they get really emotional and they start singing. It's just embarrassing."
That's great.
That was his take on it.
I beg to differ. Yeah,
it's a particular idiom.
It is.
I think I'm with that guy. I'm not too much into musicals. I do love opera.
Opera's good.
Yeah. I mean, there's, of course, there's a lot of musical songs that I respect and they're beautiful. And I respect everybody that creates musicals. It's a lot of work and it's an art.
There's room for all of it. Yeah.
Yeah. Not for me.
I can just see if you were running a house that's not a producing house and it's one musical after the next, how a straight play would be potentially a nice relief.
A nice relief.
Nobody has time for High School Musical.
Right.
Please no.
No.
Do you sing, Michael? Of course you sing, Michael. You're also a musician.
I sing. Yeah, I do sing. I haven't done a professional musical ever. I did High School Musicals. And I did workshop a musical by a friend of mine named Jim Nabel and his brother Sonny Nabel that I thought was pretty great. But it's hard to get those things launched. This was about the literary world in the village in the 50s. So I played Dylan Thomas and had a couple of solos.
Dylan Thomas.
Dylan Thomas, yeah. And I realized how you know, far behind I was these people that were really professional musical theater artists. They're just, yeah. I mean, I could get there eventually by the time we, you know, opened, yeah. But they, what they could do in, you know, a few minutes was what would take me a week.
Right.
In terms of working with the material.
It's a particular set of skills.
Yeah. There's a quote from Dylan Thomas in one of my favorite Argentinian movies. I want to try to translate it from Spanish to English because I learned in Spanish first. But it said something like, the ball that I threw in the park the last day hasn't touched the floor or something like that, or the ground.
Right.
It's so beautiful, that image. I love it so much. And then that movie, that's the movie we saw, the Dark Side of the Heart. That's the translation of the title. It's an Argentinian movie. Kevin and me saw it one time in his place.
Yeah, I remember
that. Was it Sombra la Corazón or something?
I'm sorry?
¿Cómo se dice? Dark Side.
Yeah, oh, exactly. El Lado Oscuro del Corazón.
El Lado Oscuro del Corazón.
So, yeah, it's a poet living in Argentina, in Buenos Aires, and he travels to Uruguay to sell himself, you know, doing advertising to make some money and survive. But he met this, in a brothel, he met this prostitute and he get in love with her. And she's, the story is beautiful because the prostitute knows a lot about poets from South America, and this understand this conversation and relationship, and it's about women that can fly, you know, and people that can fly. But fly is like love.
Yeah.
It's poetic. It's beautiful.
You got Neruda.
I love Neruda. Yeah, I don't know if there's any Neruda in that movie, but there's like three different poets from down there. But definitely, I love Neruda. But let's go back to.
I found the Dylan Thomas quote. You had it. The ball I threw while playing in the park has not yet reached the ground. And he's talking about
beautiful, right?
His childhood. Yeah, that's lovely. We watched the Bukowski documentary last night.
Oh, wow, right.
Yeah, that's a fun one. Very intense.
He's a little rough around the edges, beginning for female audience.
Yeah, the old Sabre was not quite sure. But then they started reading his poetry, and then it was like, oh, okay, all right.
Have you ever read his kind of memoir, fictionalized memoir called Cameron Rye.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Jeez.
Yeah. Moving.
No, the first time I got into Bukowski, funny, I'm just talking about Argentina again. My father traveled to Argentina and he brought me this book from Argentina and of a translation of Bukowski poems in Spanish, but it was with Argentinian, you know, the words and slang. And it's like, it was so crazy. But it was beautiful. I was immediately, who is this guy? It's like he was talking about, you know, I cannot even say those kind of poems right now.
Right. Because he's the poet laureate of Skid Row.
Obscure and real and beautiful. I don't know. Yeah, Bukowski was one of those.
Perpetually surprising.
A liberator.
Indeed. Yeah, indeed. Well, so Michael, obviously we're under quarantine. Are you able to do anything like work right now in terms of your acting? Maybe a little writing?
Acting, this morning I put myself on tape for Dancing at Lunasa. That's going to be done at the Bay Street Theater this summer. So we'll see. If things are open and they like me, you know, that could be a gig. We'll see. I'm actually trying to pitch and sell a pilot that I shot in the fall. I don't know if I shared that with you. I shared the link with you.
Tell me about it.
It's called Man Overboard. I play this guy named Doug Mann, who in the course of one day, his boss catches him stealing everybody's food out of the refrigerator. It's been going on forever, but sort of catch me on the security camera. I get fired for that. Come home to find my wife in bed with, colleagues. And so colleagues, plural.
Okay. All right.
She's trying to try new things. And I'm saying, oh man, I want you to try new things with me.
yeah. Funny.
And then I end up going to my mom, seeing if I can live with her. My mom's like, no, my new boyfriend doesn't like you. And so I end up living on a boat in a marina in the Bronx and sort of finding solace and community among the liveaboards on these, that people that live on the boats in marinas. So that got directed by this great British director named Sam Cadman. It's 8-minute, perfect little bite-sized pilot that we have right now with a 90-second sizzle reel. And that's going to be at the, again, if it happens, it's going up at the Austin Short Film Comedy Competition. And then we're trying to get that picked up and developed because it's funny.
That sounds
fun. You were mentioning me about this project. And I think it's pretty cool. Yeah, I was like fascinated by it immediately.
Is that, there's I'm going to share with you the 8-minute version because you can see sort of what it's going to be like. But this director is great. I've never worked with a director like this, but he actually I have kind of in certain contexts, but it's things you can't do in theater where you have like 7 alternate lines. So you go, you play the scene and then it's like, okay, they just keep going. They keep the cameras rolling and then you just try different lines, different takes, whatnot. And then you have all of this material and you can edit it down into this kind of great little, you know, whatever the best take works.
Yeah.
That poor editor. It's a lot of work.
I know.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
The producers had a session like this with me and they said, Michael, your work is great, but I have to say we're really sick of looking at you. Sorry, guys.
Sure. Yeah, indeed. How'd you get hooked up with that outfit?
Through my agent, put myself up on tape. Ironically, coincidentally, the director was he used to do this show called Trigger Happy TV, which was on Comedy Central in the 90s. And it was the first He then got into doing commercials. The first commercial, first on-camera thing I ever did, he was the director.
Yeah.
And I hadn't seen him or heard from him or anything since. And then he turns out to be the director of this thing 20-something years later.
That's wild. That's intense. 20 years.
Yeah. It was, actually, it was 2001 and this happened in 2019. So it was 18 years.
Sure. A lot of years.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, where can people find you online, Michael?
You can go to my website, www.michaelbackinson.com. You can find me on Instagram at Backintown, at Backintown, B-A-K-K-E-N-T-O-W-N.
By the way, Kevin's been trying to figure out I've been trying to find you. Instagram
I've been trying to find you this entire time.
Yeah, I'm curious. I thought, I don't have you on Instagram. I don't think so.
Backintown.
Just checking right now.
I found you.
Backintown, yep.
Outstanding. Now you're in trouble.
Yeah, and then if you want to find any of my I have 2 albums out. You can go to iTunes, you can go to Amazon, you can stream it, although then I'll get paid about a quarter of a penny. I got 2 albums up there, Lion Eyes and Sakara Grace, 2 albums of original music, and I'm working on a 3rd one right now.
Yeah, and tell us a little bit about that.
Well, it's singer-songwriter stuff. I was like Jose, I was always interested in poetry. And then at some point that just kind of started morphing into, turning the poems into songs. Yeah. So that's, yeah. So I'm always working on a song or two. I just laid down a demo last week with a guy named Doug Maxwell at Meteorite Productions that we're trying to put out a charity album for homelessness. So this is a song called I Want to Fly, from the perspective of a homeless person who's, you know, imagining having a home at some point.
Wow.
Yeah. So that's the latest thing that I have been working on.
I read recently about this movement in LA where they're trying to take back the houses that are owned by the state. It's the state of California has just a bunch of these houses have fallen to the state through foreclosure or whatever. They just don't even want them. And they're saying, why are these houses sitting empty? Why, when there are people in tents, can we figure something out? And I think
it's an issue in New York too. I also dabble in real estate, and I know for a fact. I was just talking to the super of my building that ever since the rent laws were changed to favor the tenants, landlords have been pulling units off the market and just sitting on them because somehow the way the tax system is structured. If they have a rent stabilized apartment, they can no longer make more money than what they would make leaving it empty because they can write it off in taxes. So
what a disaster.
Yeah. Talk about unintended consequences. You've got 3 bedrooms, 4 bedrooms. I had a deal fall apart this summer, you know, that people had been coming from one place they've been living in for 20 years, wanted to move into another. And when the landlord heard that, they wouldn't countersign the lease because they didn't want them to have long-term tenants. Like, oh man, so you know, there's an apartment just sitting empty right now.
What a mess. Yeah. And then when everybody talks about the efficiencies of capitalism and you see things like this, they go, no, it's not.
We were also discussing what's going to happen with rent during all this. Like, are landlords going to be a little forgiving or
there are going to be a lot of people who can't make their rents because of this.
That's going to happen.
I heard there was a moratorium on evictions right now during the crisis. I don't know what'll happen. You know, there'll be a huge backlog and a lot of fighting, I think.
I think that's probably what's going
to
happen.
We'll be in St. Paul. So how?
we are moving to St. Paul. We're really excited.
It's a paradise, St. Paul.
Well, you know, but what's fun is we'll be able to do this. We'll be able to continue.
It's definitely going
to
be better than here.
New York is New York. St. Paul is St. Paul. Yeah, you live in each place for different reasons, I think is the case.
Sure.
And I'll always have a place in my heart for New York City. I love it. It's crazy. You get kind of addicted to the grind.
I'm going to miss the pizza. I'm telling you right now. Pizza. I'm going to miss the pizza so much.
Oh, yeah. That place up the hill.
Even those places like in Midtown that are like a dollar pizza, I'm going to miss it with all that grease. And there's nothing like
that. And I know you love the pizza.
Yeah.
I've seen you maybe like 10 times getting food from across the street and maybe 6 of those is pizza, man.
I love pizza.
Well,
got all the food groups. Guilty.
Carbs. I had another health test when I was like 8. It was like, is a Hawaiian pizza, does it fulfill all the food groups? And I was like, yes.
It's got meat,
got it marked wrong. I was like, what?
Yeah. Wow.
I can deal with that.
Let's do the last 5-10 minutes of this episode. Let's do a round robin and talk about how we're surviving Corona mentally. And maybe we'll start to my left with Sabra. How are you surviving Corona?
I mean, I'm by nature a little bit more of an introvert, so for me to kind of go into like a dark place and sort of be there is pretty comfortable for me. But I've been doing a lot of like looking at podcasts, like really exploring a lot of those. I listen to a lot of haunted podcasts. I'm a little bit of a paranormal junkie, so I listen to a lot of stuff like that.
All right.
I'm sort of like, I've been feeling creatively constricted. I write myself, and I've just been trying to let my brain sort of relax and maybe like open up to new writing ideas and look at the stuff I've written in the past. I think this is a great time. Also, you know, we're expecting, so that's another thing to think about as well.
Huge.
Mm-hmm. So
yeah,
I'm just thinking about, but we're in the transition, so I'm trying to figure out like, okay, I'm ready to go back and like restart. But in the meantime, I'm just trying to not get at this one's throat.
Right, yeah. And we have a studio apartment here, so it's not, there's not the most room in the world for two people to be on top of each other. We're taking a lot of walks is the plan.
Yes.
And I've got to get outside, got to get out there. What about you, Backinson? What are you doing with your family?
Similar kind of stuff. I mean, I've still been running around a little bit. Yesterday was kind of the first day that I didn't, you know, head all over town. That's just sort of I'm always, you know, dealing with this, that, or the other. So I'm not a huge extrovert. Like, I have to be in huge groups or something, but I love freedom of movement. So So that is kind of obnoxious. And just having that outlet of going, like, to Kismet, where I met you guys, to sit down for half an hour, have a drink, have a chat, catch up with people.
Yeah.
I'm already feeling claustrophobic that is not an option.
Yeah. Cheers is shut down.
It is shut down.
Cheers is shut down.
Yeah. It is.
Yeah. Oof.
Yeah.
No.
But on the other hand, I've had good conversations with family, with friends that I haven't talked to in a while, texts. I'm trying to get in touch with my students, figuring out how we're going to continue the teaching. So there's a lot of kind of problem solving that I've been doing over the last few days. So that's, even though I kind of want to be exhausted and done with everything, there's been a lot of little logistics that I've had to figure out about how I'm going to make stuff work over the next few months or weeks, whatever it turns out to be.
Yeah.
We just got the psychedelic portraiture back for this episode.
Oh, so already?
I think you'll be happy with the,
excellent.
So. Yeah.
Oh, I love the one with you guys and the one with Sabra. That was really cool.
Those are from our
that's
photos.
Great.
Yeah.
I can't wait to share that with my family.
Isn't that fun? And this is, of course, Peniel Collada on Twitter. And she does this portraiture for every episode of this podcast, which you can see at getthispodcast.com. I just set up an Instagram account, too, for the podcast.
Cool.
So I'm going to have all of these portraits over time. We'll continue to grow it, and that handle is Get This Podcast. So, Jose, how are you going to survive Corona, John?
I thought you forget to ask.
Dude, you know, it's not just the dulcet tones,
man.
Remember,
I got my feelings, you know.
I'm a very – everybody gets a turn.
All right. Thank you for asking. No, I mean, you know, as you guys know, Cheers was closed last night, the restaurant where I work, Gizmat.
Everybody's going to cheers.
No, I go to say the same thing I was telling at the beginning. Like, I'm just relaxed, and in some way, it's a weird relaxation, and, you know, kind of really feeling this, I don't know, this soothiness in the environment all the time. Lately, like, everybody's quiet in their houses with the people they love, if they love them. Yeah. All of that. I don't know. That
we'll
kind
see
of like
in a couple of months.
It's all around the world. It's all around the world, and that's kind of beautiful right now. The carbon dioxide is going down in many cities. The world is finally
less
getting some
breathing
oxygen.
Air outside.
Yeah, you know, I'm with you, Jose. We do. Yeah. I've said this before on the podcast. We need a little break from the carnival. There's nothing wrong with just pressing pause for a minute. Obviously, it's a very serious situation. We hope everyone stays safe and healthy, and our hearts go out to everybody affected thus far. It is interesting that it brings us all together in this recognition of our shared humanity. There's no avoiding it now. And I think it's going to make a lot of people, you know, it's going to force a lot of people to look inward and do some thinking.
Mm-hmm.
I think that has some value.
I also saw a really funny meme. It was, our grandparents got sent to war. You're getting sent to sit on your couch. You can do this.
Yes, definitely. I saw that one recently. I think you sent it to us or something. Yeah, that was really.
I've been seeing it everywhere. It's gone viral a little bit. It's really
funny. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So yeah, definitely. Yeah. I kind of said these words because we're kind of going to be in London.
We'll see.
My grandpa used to say when we were sitting on a table and for lunch or dinner, and we were like, oh my God, chicken again. You know, I was like, my grandpa, you eat that thing because in China world, you eat, you know, that.
Yeah. You eat what's put in front of you.
Yeah.